Hello, folks. Welcome to podcast number 30 of the Sands series, where we cover the newsletters of Sands and give our thoughts on what's going on in the landscape. I'm Jared Reimer. You may email or iMessage the address tech, that's T-E-C-H, at menvi.org. You may text or WhatsApp the phone number 804-442-6975. Or you may call the comment line at 888-405-7524. And if you would like your comments aired for a Sands News Bites, then please let me know what you think. And you want it aired? We'll get it aired for you on the next available taping of the program. So this is going to be Sands News Bites, annotated news update from the leader in information, security, training, certification, and research. December 9th, 2025, volume 27, number 89. And if you would like a Braille file, you can let me know. We transcribe it by default in English Braille American Edition. And you can, in theory, ask me for an English Braille American Edition or the Unified English Braille Edition. And if you would like a 30-cell version, I can get that to you. Okay? I am Jared Reimer, and I transcribe this. I'm located in Woodland Hills, California, in L.A. County. Okay. Here is the table of contents for the newsletter, which aired, was released. And the top of the news is going to be as follows. React. Critical flaw exploited worldwide. Cloudflare disrupted while mitigating. Number two. Investigate brick storm persistence. Warn CISA and Canada's Cyber Center. And finally, U.S. Treasury Financial Crime Enforcement Network, FinCEN, received reports of 2.1 billion dollars in ransomware payments between 2022 and 2024. Let's talk now about what's in the table of contents for the rest of the news for this particular newsletter. There are 7 items, if my memory serves me, after doing this. And since I can't put a bullet in the file, I can, in theory, put numbers. Update AppAche. Or is it... No, this is Apache. Sorry. This is update Apache Tika to fix CVSS 10.0 XXE flaw. All right, so again, the update item is update Apache Tika to fix CVSS 10.0 XXE flaw. Item number two. OWASP publishes practical guide for securely using third-party MCP servers. Number three, Cloudflare blocks 29.7 TBPS DDoS attack from Isuru. Number four, JP Cert CC advisory warns of vulnerability in array networks AG series. Five, Nader. Well, they might pronounce it Nader in some places, but it's actually NATO, N-A-T-O. Cyber defense exercise emphasizes international collaboration. Six, Portugal updates cybercrime law to create good faith exemption for researchers. And finally, brothers face prison sentences for allegedly deleting government databases in former employers' systems. Okay. That is our table of contents. And I know this program's starting a little bit rough, but I hope that you will enjoy the content that it has. By the way, we do from time to time put in what the editors have to say. Especially with content that I'm not too familiar with, if I feel it helps with the conversation. And when I do, I quote them in the Braille file and we'll put their name in. And remember that each of the items can be found in the newsletter, and all of them can be found when you go to the RSS, you go to the newsletter. And of course, all of the editors are listed at the end of the newsletter, and we put them into the podcast so people know exactly who's responsible for putting these news journals together. So, we're a little bit rough as we get started, but let's get started now with Top of the News on page one. And we start now with React. And they've got a critical flaw exploited worldwide, Cloudflare disrupted, mitigating. A CVSS 10.0 vulnerability, CVE 2025-55182, dubbed React 2 Shell, and this is React with the number 2 shell, and the R and the S are capitalized, allowing unauthenticated remote code execution due to unsafe deserialization in React server components, was reported on November 29th, 2025, and has since been confirmed as actively exploited worldwide. The flaw was publicly disclosed and patched on Wednesday, December 3rd. But reports from AWS honeypots and analysis from Graynoise and Shadow Server, among others, confirm opportunistic exploitation by multiple threat actors believed to be Chinese state-sponsored groups. These attacks use both automated scanning tools and individual PLC exploits, some of which leverage public PLCs that don't actually work in real-world scenarios, demonstrating, and this is the bracketed ING, I don't know why they do this, fundamental misunderstandings of the vulnerability. According to AWS, who posit that the threat actors are prioritizing speed over accuracy, relying on a high volume of scans, abusing the availability of even ineffective public exploits, and potentially benefiting from masking by noise generated in failed attempts. The default configuration of React and downstream Next.js are vulnerable, Shadow Server reported. 77,664 vulnerable IPs observed on December 6th, and Sinis has observed just over 2.15 million instances of internet-facing services that may be affected by this vulnerability, emphasizing that any internet-accessible server running affected React server components code should be assumed vulnerable until updated as a precaution. Users are urged to update immediately, and federal agencies must do so by December 26th, as the flaw has been added to the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency's CISA's Known Exploited Vulnerabilities KEV catalog. Well, folks, if you didn't think that this was possible, think again. This, although I feel, is sloppy work, because this is saying that what they're producing is not even working. Usually what we see are people understanding what they're looking at, because of course they read the particulars of what was fixed and they reverse engineer it to see if they could find some way else. And in some circumstances, the same vulnerability is still exploited even though the patch is there, because they found another method that the patch doesn't fix, bringing in another patch. So what I'm saying here is that whoever's doing this is just trying to put out noise now. And maybe that could be a good thing. Maybe that could be a bad thing. But when they get this right and their exploits actually work, is when you really gotta pay attention. This is going to be a long road, and December 26th is going to be several weeks away. Meanwhile, Cloudflare CTO Dane Nechte reports that a global Cloudflare outage on Friday, December 5th, affecting about 28% of HTTP traffic served by Cloudflare, was triggered by changes being made to Cloudflare's body parsing logic while the provider was implementing detections and mitigations for the React flaw in its Web Application Firewall, WAF, and that's WAF. So, I don't blame Cloudflare necessarily for this, because they handle mitigation of all kinds of things that the average user may not see. And lots of sites use them for what's known as distributed denial of service mitigation services or denial of service mitigations. So, only affecting 28% is not necessarily bad, but they were trying to fix something and implement something which can address issues that are going on at this time. So, you know, this type of thing can happen to anybody. any provider that provides any service. I don't think this could necessarily be a Cloudflare problem. All three folks commenting on this section have lots to say. Don't delay patching if you are affected. Do what's right. You don't want to find out they finally got their exploit right. Noise is how it starts. When they get it right, it's game over, I write. And I was talking about that before I read the question dealing with Cloudflare, because I want to reiterate the fact that this can happen to anyone, and as far as outages go, and we know that noise started in regards to, you know, worms and viruses and other things we see on a regular, although viruses, worms, and Trojans are not the same anymore. It's pretty much all ransomware these days. But it all started with noise. Somebody had an idea, put it out there, infected, I don't know, let's call it 1,000 people, and called it good. It's not going to matter to them. They're not going to care that it gave out noise. You know, people uploading these things to VirusTotal and providers then putting signatures to it. It's all noise. So all of this noise can benefit us all in the long run, because while it's not known, and while in this case the code to exploit whatever they're trying to exploit is bad, it's all interstitial. It's something to cause havoc, even if it doesn't work quite right, to prepare for what might be bigger once you really understand the bigger picture. Item number two for top of the news, and this time it's Brickstorm, something I may have heard about but not really read much about. Investigate Brickstorm persistence. Warn CISA and Canada's Cyber Center. The U.S. Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, CISA, working alongside the Canadian Center for Cybersecurity, Cyber Center, have released a report urging organizations to investigate for the presence of Brickstorm malware. The two North American cybersecurity authorities warn that VPRC state-sponsored cyber actors have gained long-term persistent access for months or years in some cases, and may still be doing so. The report analyzes 8 different samples of executable and linkable format ELF malware written in Go, which targets primarily VMware, vSphere, and Windows environments and creates a stealthy backdoor with capabilities for initiation persistence and secure command and control C2. To aid detection, the report offers YARA rules, a Sigma rule, and other resources, including tactics, techniques, and procedures, TTPs, and instructions for running scanning scripts by Mandiant and CrowdStrike. U.S. organizations should report any related activity by email or phone to CISA's 24/7 Operations Center or through the Incident Reporting System and submit malicious files through the Malware Analysis Submission Form. Canadian organizations should report using CyberCenter's online reporting tool or by email. CISA, NSA, and CyberCenter recommend mitigations that align with cross-sector cybersecurity performance goals, CPGs. Keep VMware vSphere servers up to date and harden their environments, inventory, and monitor all network edge devices. Disable RDP and SMB from the DMZ to the internal network and ensure traffic between the two is restricted with proper segmentation. Monitor service accounts and restrict their permissions, applying the principle of least privilege, and block unauthorized DOH providers and external DOH network traffic. I did not comment on this because I think it is going to speak for itself. So that is where we are, and we want people to know that this is something that they need to take advantage of by patching it, because it's out there and is a problem. Just because I don't know much about it, and they seem to have done a great job in their write-up without me having to take their comments, means I don't have to say anything, except I'm telling you now that you should patch this thing. Okay. So, let's go ahead and move on to our final item in the top of the news segment. U.S. Treasury Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, FIN7, received reports of $2.1 billion in ransomware payments between 2022 and 2024. A report from the U.S. Treasury's Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, FIN7, says more than $2 billion in ransomware payments were reported under the Bank Secrecy Act, BSA, between 2022 and 2024. The total amount of ransomware payments reported to FinCEN under BSA during the preceding 9 years was $2.4 billion. According to the report, reported ransomware payments peaked in 2023, 1,512 incidents involving a total of $1.1 billion in ransomware payments. The numbers decreased somewhat in 2024 with 1,476 reported incidents and $734 million in reported ransomware payments. The report identifies financial services, manufacturing, and healthcare as the most frequently targeted sectors and notes 267 unique ransomware variants reported in BSA data during the review period. Approximately 432% of the BSA reports included information about how the ransomware operators communicated with their victims. Of those, 67% used the Onion Router, Tor, and 28% used email. Bitcoin was identified as the method of payment in 97% of reported incidents. Established in 1970, the Bank Secrecy Act authorizes the Department of the Treasury to impose reporting and other requirements on financial institutions and other businesses to help detect and prevent money laundering. I really need to learn how to slow down and read this correctly. I know that sometimes I'll just go back and correct it as I go, but I read this section so wrong that I have to re-record it. But as I do so, I do want to say that this is very interesting because that doesn't mean that money's recovered. It could be lost money, and it could, in theory, mean that a good chunk of that may never be recovered. Well, some possibly could. Now, let's see if I could read this correctly and not stumble through things. Neely writes, "If you decide to pay the ransom, be prepared for your FI to report it. This is required by law. If you're dealing with an embargoed or other entity covered by OFAC, there may be consequences. As such, have conversations not only with your legal team, but also with your FI's team. Better to understand reporting and consequences now than when the chips are down." And FI stands for financial institution, by the way. So, they can, in theory, reimburse you if it's not terrible, if you recognize right away, well, you know, these guys did whatever, I fell for it. They could, in theory, reimburse you if you report it quick enough. They could, in theory, get the money stopped at the same time, but as I said, sometimes it's just lost. And they still have to report it as lost money, even if you don't get reimbursed for it. So, yeah. All right, Dukes also writes, "As if you needed further proof to why ransomware persists, here it is. Criminals go to where the money is, and companies are still willing to pay the ransom to get access back to their systems. Both of these are great things to put in for your discussion points. And I say that as we turn the page to the rest of the week's news, which will be on page 7 of the 40-cell file, we have still a lot to learn. Because I don't necessarily blame companies for paying the ransom. Trying to back up terabytes and terabytes of data and then getting it back when you make a mistake by going to the provider and say, "Give me the last backup," which was, let's say, a week ago, of all of my data. You know, that could take a long, long time. And I get it. And part of the reason why it takes a long time is because of the fact that you are keeping data on consumers that either A, you don't need for your day-to-day operations, or B, you're keeping data on consumers who have left your company and haven't been back in a period of years. So, how is that working for everybody? I do have outdated data, but it's in a file I don't even use anymore. I could technically delete it. And my customer list is elsewhere now. So, I've kept that other list in case I absolutely need it. But again, I don't use it. But it was a small file anyway. And it's not stored on the public internet. Enjoying our SANS coverage of what we have to say in regards to the newsletter? Yes, I know. I need to slow down a little bit. And maybe I could do a better job editing, but this could take all day, seeing that it takes me over an hour to read the file I prepared, which even takes longer to prepare in Braille. So besides those issues, let me know what you think. You can email or iMessage tech, that's TECH, at menvi.org. Text or WhatsApp 804-442-6975. Or you may call the comment line at 888-405-7524. And let me know what you think. I know the podcast is still a work in progress, and we are definitely trying the best we can to get everything in order. So, what do you think? Let us know. The rest of the week's news. Update Apache Tika to fix CVSS 10.0XXE flaw. And we talked about XXE when that became a term, when they mentioned it, I believe, in the last episode. Apache has released a security advisory disclosing a maximum severity flaw affecting Apache Tika Core before version 3.2.2, Tika PDF module before version 3.2.2, and Tika parsers before version 2.0.0, so 2 flat. Apache Tika is a content analysis toolkit that detects and extracts metadata and text from over 1,000 different file types, all parsed through a single interface. CVE 2025 CVSS score 10.0 allows an attacker to conduct XML external entity XXE injection using a crafted XFA file inside a PDF file for Tika to parse. Now, first of all, why would I personally run some file format I've never heard of, which is an XFA file? And second of all, why would I be expecting other files besides images? What is an XFA file anyway? I've never heard of it. I know all of the common, well-known extensions. Some of these others, which I've seen through the years in recent email attacks, I've never heard of. And I don't have a program to run them. If I ran a PDF file that I wasn't expecting, I know I'm in trouble. Apache notes that this flaw is the same as CVE 2025-54988, which was initially fixed in just the Tika Parser PDF module in August 2025. The new CVE expands the scope to include Tika Core, which is also vulnerable and must be updated to 3.2.2 or newer. Also noting that the original report failed to mention that in the 1.x Tika releases, the PDF parser was in the org.apache.tika : Tika parsers module. I believe that's what this is. And I should have really paid attention, because I could have put that in computer braille for me to better read. If you use this update, Ulrich writes, Apache Tika is a popular choice to extract data from documents. This vulnerability is easy to exploit and must be patched quickly if you are using Tika to parse documents from untrusted sources. Again, this is why I ask, why would I run such a file? If somebody's sending me an XFA file, I would be asking them what it's for. You know, I actually did that once. I got something that claimed that they were sending me an attachment. And I told them, replied back and said, please send your attachment again. Word said that it could not open the file. And I never heard another word. So... also, my boss at the time said, never respond to these guys, they're trying to infect you. And I'm like, well, I'm trying to be nice. I'm not hiring, but I wanted to open the resume, and not being able to do so because Word was saying, you can't do that, I decided to be nice, and I never got a response. But I since quit doing that. If it's something I'm waiting for, I'll deal. Let's see. Neely writes, if you're using Tika, make sure you are on the latest versions of all components. Everyone is on the same page, and I don't know anything about this. I write, get patching. So, that's all I really have to say about that. Because there isn't anything else to say except that 10 is the highest score you can have in the CVSS category. That's the Common Vulnerability Scoring System. So, if that doesn't make you go patch, then I can't help you. Well, I'm glad I wrote this next section in such a way where I probably would be mispronouncing this, knowing that it would use a contraction. This is something called OWASP. O-W-A-S-P. OWASP. The headline is, OWASP publishes practical guide for securely using third-party MCP servers. That's managed service providers, unless they're talking about something else. But the Open Web Application Security Project, OWASP, Gen AI Security Project, has published the Practical Guide for Securely Using Third-Party MCP Servers. The document outlines the unique security risks introduced by connecting AI models to third-party tools and data sources, including tool poisoning, prompt injection, memory prisoning, and tool interference. And offers actionable mitigations covering authentication, authorization, client sandboxing, secure server discovery, and governance workflows, emphasizing least privileged access and human in the loop oversight. The Model Context Protocol, MCP, is an open source standard. All right, so I was wrong to begin with, even though I read this, but I forgot. Model Concept Protocol is what this stands for. MCP is an open source standard developed to help AI interact safely with external systems. SC Media writes that OWASPs, and here's where I did not change the OWASP. Good job. cheat sheet addresses the importance of understanding server privileges, restricting and validating behavior, and continuously monitoring runtime activity. Well, okay. If that's the only mistake I made, and I tried correcting everything that I could try. We will see what happens. So, Cloudflare. They are the next item up. The item is Cloudflare blocks 29.7 TBPS DDoS attack from Esuru. Cloudflare's quarterly DDoS threat report for Q3 of 2025 released on December 3rd highlights the prevalence of attacks from the Esuru botnet, including an unprecedented hypervolumetric attack peaking at 29.7 terabits per second TBPS and 14.1 billion packets per second BPPS. Cloudflare detected and mitigated the attack, emphasizing that Esuru, which can be partially employed as a botnet for hire, is capable of disrupting parts of the U.S. internet infrastructure when said ISPs were not even the target of the attack. DDoS attacks against AI companies rose by 347% month over month. Also increasing for the mining, minerals, and metals and automotive industries. Year over year, the total number of DDoS attacks grew by 40% quarter over quarter. The number grew by 15%, and the number of hypervolumetric attacks grew by 54%. Averaging 14 hypervolumetric attacks daily. By Q3 Cloudflare has already mitigated 36.2 million DDoS attacks. That corresponds to 170% of the DDoS attacks Cloudflare mitigated throughout 2024. The report offers statistics on attack sources, targeted industries and locations, and vectors. Neely writes, go back and read the traffic volume numbers again. Yeah, I'm old. And flashing back to the throughput we had in X25 and dial-up networking networks. Amazing, isn't it? Now go make sure you're fully covered for DDoS protections. Don't forget to check your third-party providers to see if they are good to go. Make sure there aren't steps you need to take and haven't. I'm that old too, Neely. Maybe you are older than I, but we speak the same language here. And yes, he might be older than I, because I'm not familiar with anything about X25, but I know dial-up. So, yeah. Have fun with this one. All right, folks. We are going to move along now, as I just took that last segment and gave it to Throwback because maybe they'll be interested. We actually thought it would be interesting for them. So, here we go with our next item. JP Cert CC advisory warns a vulnerability in array networks AG series. Japan's JP Cert CC, that's JP Cert slash CC, has published an advisory describing a command injection vulnerability in desktop direct function of Array Networks, Array AG series secure access gateways. While Array Networks released an update in May 2025 that includes a fix for the vulnerability, JP Cert CC has confirmed that attacks exploiting this vulnerability have occurred in Japan since August 2025, resulting in damage such as the installation of web shells on affected products. The flaw affects ArrayOS AG versions 9.4.5.8 and earlier. JPCC recommends updating to a newer fixed version, noting that rebooting the product after applying the fixed version may result in the loss of logs. Array Networks has also provided a workaround. If you are not using the Desktop Direct feature, disable all Desktop Direct services. Use a URL filter to deny access to URLs that contain, and then you've got apostrophe, semicolon, so left quote, so this is going to be left quote, semicolon, right quote, period, and I believe this is apostrophe. The vulnerability has been added to CISA's known exploited vulnerabilities catalog with a mitigation deadline of December 29th, 2025 for federal civilian executive branch agencies. Newly has what you should do. Read what he has to say. Better yet, here's what he has to say. Three things to do here. First, make sure logs are being sent off device. Second, apply the update. Third, disable unused features such as Desktop Direct. Lastly, to really tighten things up, apply a filter blocking URLs which contain, and then we have apostrophe, semicolon, we have a period, and a right quote, and a quote, I believe, is what this is. Do it and move along, I write. Maybe you better read this in the newsletter to make sure you got all the punctuations right. Because, I don't want to give you wrong information. And the newsletter will be linked in our show notes. And now that I'm starting to understand how to link correctly within the RSS feed, you'll see better linking now, because I'm going to have to go in, even when I code it locally, I'm going to have to go in and recode it and highlight that until the whole thing is a link so that it understands that. And I'm actually trying it on recent items, and we will see if that doesn't fix any of these issues with links not working like they should. All right. So, here is our next item. And maybe some people pronounce this Nato. Some people pronounces it Nader. But here is what this really is. NATO. NATO cyber defense exercise emphasizes international collaboration. Last week, NATO held its annual cyber defense exercise. The Cyber Coalition exercise brought together representatives of 29 allied nations and 7 partner nations to respond to 7 storylines, including scenarios involving military networks, fuel depots, power plants, and commercial satellites. Exercise Director, U.S. Navy Commander Brian Kaplan, noted that the storylines are designed so no nation can win the war unless they communicate with others. Only by sharing information and working together can they understand the attack and respond effectively. Roughly 200 of the exercise's participants were on site for the drill. The rest participated remotely. Kaplan offered this reminder: in cyberspace, there are no boundaries. Something that happens in one nation can have a second or third order effect in another. That's why information sharing, trust, and collaboration are essential. I'm going to put both Neely and Duke in here for context, as they understand this more than I. Neely writes, added resources, points of view, and approaches make defense and response easier and more effective. Threat actors often target sectors, not just individual companies. Do you have relationships with your peer organizations such that you could work together on thwarting common threats? May come in handy these days. Dukes writes, sage advice from the U.S. Navy commander, which has applicability to non-military networks as well. If you haven't already, consider joining a sector-specific information sharing and analysis center, ISAC, and subscribe to cyber alerts from both CISA and the FBI. And there I do see I did not change U.S. to the English equivalent, because it should not be contracted when saying U.S. But I only spotted that now, and I thought I spotted that and corrected it there. NVDA's speech that I'm using does make it a little bit difficult for me to deal with some of these things, but I'm doing the best I can. And like I said, both have good things to say. I am on Sis's email list, but honestly, I know I haven't read it in a good while, and it's pretty good. Recently, they changed the way they do their alerts, where they link to everything, and you have to go out and read if you want to learn more, but the email list is still there. Would I believe everything they have to say when our own government can't even do what's recommended? That's not up for debate for this podcast. You make that decision on your own. I'm not going to debate that. But when it comes to putting out information, they do a good job of it. Well, folks, let's move on now to Portugal. And this means that more nations are coming together to do something pretty good, I think. The item in question this time is Portugal updates cybercrime law to create good faith exemption for researchers. Portugal's legislature has updated the country's cybercrime law to include a good faith exemption for cybersecurity research. The new provision, Article 8A, comes with a set of guidelines, including that the research must focus solely on identifying the existence of vulnerabilities in information systems, products, and services of information and communication technologies, which were not created by itself or by a third party on which it depends, and with the purpose of contributing to the security of cyberspace. Through their disclosure, that the researcher cannot seek to obtain payment beyond payment for professional services, the research cannot violate general data protection regulation, GDPR, standards. The researcher may not use illegal activities such as DDoS and DDoS. So both are listed here, although they're in the opposite order, but in this case it really doesn't matter. Attacks, social engineering, phishing, data theft, alteration or deletion of computer data, willful damage to information systems, or installation or distribution of malware and data obtained in the research process be deleted within 10 days of the vulnerability being fixed. The new provision was first noted by security researcher Daniel Cuthbertson. Other countries have made similar changes to their laws regarding security researchers. In November 2024, Germany's Federal Ministry of Justice introduced draft legislation of similar protections. And in May 2022, the U.S. Department of Justice, DOJ, and here I go again, not fixing U.S., but I remember that's what it is, added a good faith research exemption to the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, CFAA, violations policy. Neely writes, having provisions like this is a step in the right direction. Being arrested for just having common research tools is untenable. That said, with multiple countries implementing provisions for cyber research, it's important to understand where the guardrails are. Beware of both technique, restrictions, and data retention limits. Don't forget to fold in the VDP limitations of the company you're investigating. You don't want to test the consequences provisions of this legislation. Dukes says, Portugal now joins a growing list of countries that have already made the policy change. This is simply to protect the good guys from possible litigation, given their research is often at odds with the security of a vendor's product. Murray, who hasn't spoken much lately, also writes, a researcher, and by the way, that's in quotes, and there have been quoted material, but I have not mentioned every item, but in this case I will, because this is important. A researcher that works without supervision or collaboration is indistinguishable from a rogue hacker. Any law intended to license research should include such a test. All great points, and I can't say enough myself, because we see people arrested for violating whatever the CFAA is in their country, and come to find out all they did was report a vulnerability to a company that they found independently. And it doesn't matter how you find it. Maybe it's through, you know, researching something on Shodan, which is a search engine for looking for vulnerable devices. Maybe something caught their attention, or maybe they had a hypothesis about something they were reading and they wanted to research it and dig deeper. So they, you know, opened Shodan and found something and decided to go poke around and saw something and did something, and then decided, this can't be good. I'm going to go to the company and report this and maybe help them fix it. And they go to do that and get slapped with a lawsuit or get thrown in jail because all they did was access something through, say, the aforementioned search engine, which is publicly available on the internet. So I say, good job. This is exactly what we need, and that should really be enough of this. I believe that this type of thing should be in all nations. where research is welcomed. Just doing something to cause harm and other types of problems is not. So, I say yes to this. What says you? Your comments are welcome. All right, folks, this is going to be our last item, and this is a bunch of some good news. So let's get right to this. Brothers face prison sentence for allegedly deleting government databases in former employers' systems. On December 3rd, 2025, U.S. authorities arrested two Virginia men for their roles in a conspiracy to destroy government databases hosted by a federal government contractor. According to court documents, brothers Munib Akhtar and Sahib Akhtar were fired from their jobs at an unnamed company on February 18, 2025, and allegedly sought revenge. The U.S. Department of Justice, this is where I actually got this correct, the U.S. Department of Justice, DOJ, writes, following the termination of their employment, the brothers allegedly sought to harm the company and its U.S. government customers by accessing computers without authorization, issuing commands to prevent others from modifying the databases before deletion, deleting databases, stealing information, and destroying evidence of their unlawful activity. Well, of course, that's what you want to do. Destroy the evidence so that there's no proof of it ever happening, even though it did? Sure, that's what a smart criminal would do. And when I said that I actually got it correct, in that instance of the U.S. Department of Justice, I actually got that correct and fixed U.S. from the grade 2 version to the grade 1 version as required by Braille rules. Munib allegedly deleted an estimated 96 databases in February 2025. Many of those databases contained information and documents related to Freedom of Information Act matters and sensitive government investigation files. Munib Akhtar is charged with conspiracy to commit computer fraud and to destroy records, two counts of computer fraud, theft of U.S. government records, and two counts of aggravated identity theft. Sahib Akhtar is charged with conspiracy to commit computer fraud and to destroy records and computer fraud, password trafficking. Munib faces up to 45 years in prison. Sahib faces up to 6 years in prison. In 2015, the brothers pleaded guilty to wire fraud, conspiring to break into U.S. State Department systems, and there I go again, not making sure U.S. is correct here. Oops. Both served time in prison for those offenses. So this isn't their first rodeo. Why one's only getting 6 and the other 45 is beyond me. Maybe it's the type of charges here. But I write, so long, guys. News like this is awesome to hear. Neely writes, while their past history includes malfeasance, they served their time. The focus needs to be on how they were able to maintain access after termination. Again, same problem, different day. How many times have we talked about this? Time and time again. Make sure you have a tight loop on locking down credentials upon termination. Even PIV badges, which are usable across agencies and utilize certificates, can be deactivated quickly. Verify your process works across all authentication methods. Don't forget derived authentication. There may be other processes you need to implement to disable these secondary methods. Dukes writes, once again, a company did not have a well-rehearsed process in place for the removal of employees from employment. The documented process should engage direct supervisors, HR, talent management, IT, and legal. And here we go with me not fixing IT there, but I knew it was IT and not the word it. I need to slow down. Most importantly, immediately upon notification of employee removal, access to the building and IT systems should be restricted. Whether they are serving time or not, these two people in this newsletter have great points. I hope the company will learn its lesson. And this can't be stated enough. We've talked about this time and time again, where people are having access because they have a grudge, and that access is still there, even though it really should not be, because the company thinks, oh, well, they know they're not here, they're good, you know, they're not going to bother us anymore. But you can't assume that anymore. You cannot assume that people are going to not be good citizens. You just don't know what they're going to do. And I talked about this in the last newsletter, and that segment was one of two from podcast 29 that were similar. And here we go. We're going to take this segment again and give it to throwback again for them to chew on. And I already know what the team is going to do. They're going to chew on it, and they're going to yap about what is going on over here. It is absolutely awful. And companies haven't learned. All right, folks. We are done with all of the items. The editorial board of Sans News Bites include Brian Honan, Kurt Dukes, Chris Elge, David Holzer, Ed Scoutis, Gao Spitzner, we've not heard from in a little while, Jake Williams, Dr. Johannes Ulrich, John Pescator, Josh Wright, Kathy Bradford, Lance Spitzner, Lee Neely, Mark Weatherford, Moses Frost, Suzanne Vatrenault, and William Hugh Murray. Sands Institute is located at 11200 Rockville Pike, Suite 200, North Bethesda, Maryland, 20852. Email support@sands.org or call 301-654-7267 if you have trouble with newsletter issues. And from now on, we're going to put the editorial board on one page and other contact information on another page, because it goes on to another page anyway, and most of the time it's at the top of the page, and so I think that's what we are going to do there. Well, folks, that is all we have for you on today's edition of the Sans News Bites program. This was the newsletter for December 9th, and I'm continuing to work through, and we will have plenty of time where we will make sure that we get stuff out there, even during our holiday break. And we will go ahead and catch up with you on another edition of the program very soon. Thanks so much for listening, and make it a great day.